From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, hanging with the homeboys, we talk with Joseph Vasquez, the writer and director of a new comic film about four friends, two black and two Latino, in the South Bronx. That's where Vasquez grew up, in a family that was half black and half Latino. Also today, the Hollywood-Washington connection. Journalist Ronald Brownstein explains how politicians use celebrities to get votes and why the celebrities go along with it. Rock historian Ed Ward discusses one of 1963's most unlikely hits. And TV critic David Bianculli welcomes back Public TV's documentary series, POV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The all-white South African parliament voted today to repeal one of the last of the country's apartheid laws, the BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
41 years after it was introduced as the fundamental pillar of apartheid, the Population Registration Act is no more. From now on, newly born babies will no longer be classified according to their race. The Population Registration Act provided the legal basis for apartheid's greatest cruelties: the division of families and communities, the denial of basic rights to generations of South Africans. President de Klerk conjured up biblical imagery when he addressed Parliament. The prodigal son had come back from the pig swill of apartheid. If the international community had any morality left, it would kill the fatted calf of sanctions, he said, though the state president denied that the act had been repealed simply to facilitate the removal of sanctions. White conservatives have accused the government of treason. The ANC has welcomed the repeal of the act, but has been quick to point out that without political rights, blacks remain second-class citizens.
The BBC's Fergal Keane. The Congress Party appears to have taken a strong lead in India's national elections. The party's leader, former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, was assassinated in a bomb attack during the campaign. Party officials are now preparing to select a new leader and form a government. Partial election returns indicate that the Congress Party failed to win a majority in Parliament, so the new Prime Minister may try to form a ruling coalition. According to the early returns, a right-wing Hindu party appeared to be the second biggest vote-getter. The Supreme Court today made it more difficult for prisoners to win lawsuits challenging unfit living conditions in confinement. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The case before the Supreme Court marked the first time in 20 years that the U.S. government had sided with a prisoner in a Supreme Court case involving prison conditions. At issue was a challenge to conditions at the Hocking Correctional Facility in Nelsonville, Ohio. Prisoner Pearlie Wilson charged that the prison was freezing cold in the winter and scalding hot in the summer, that the lavatories were filthy, the kitchens rat-infested, and that the prison was so overcrowded that inmates were housed with the physically and mentally ill. These conditions, he charged, amounted to cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Constitution. But today the Supreme Court ruled by a 5-4 vote that unless prison officials acted with deliberate indifference in perpetuating these conditions, the prisoners could not successfully sue to force change. The four dissenters warned that today's ruling may allow inhumane conditions to continue if officials can show that they don't have the money to correct them. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Stock prices slipped a bit today on Wall Street after a mixed session. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 6 points to close at 2,993.96. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-3 in light trading. This is NPR News. A federal judge ruled today that the Virginia Military Institute can continue its males-only admission policy, despite the fact that it receives public funding. The Justice Department sued VMI last year, claiming that the exclusion of women at a public college violates the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act. District Judge Jackson Kaiser ruled today that the Institute's all-male policy is constitutional and that the admission of women would interfere with its rigorous training program. Critics of the college point out that the U.S. service academies have admitted women since 1978. More than 50 years of troubled relations between Germany and Poland were brought to an end today as the leaders of the two countries signed a historic friendship treaty. The accord, signed in Bonn by German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and Polish Prime Minister Jan Bielecki, affirms mutual respect for the Polish-German border and guarantees the rights of ethnic Germans living in Poland. Tom Jelton reports from Berlin.
Tensions between Poles and Germans go back hundreds of years, and the animosity runs deep. Even today, Poles have not forgiven Germans for the Nazis' invasion and occupation of their country in 1939. Many Germans, for that matter, resent the loss of part of their country's territory to Poland at the end of the Second World War, and they agitated for years to get the land back. Now, that question is closed. The treaty signed today commits each country to recognize the other's sovereignty and independence. Poland guarantees that German people left in Polish territory have the right to use their own language and have their own cultural and religious associations. Germany agrees to cooperate with Poland in economic, cultural, and security affairs. I'm Tom Gelton in Berlin.
Authorities in Charleston, South Carolina, say that at least three people are dead and nearly three dozen more were injured today in an explosion and fire at a chemical plant. Four of the injuries are said to be in critical condition. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hangin' with the Homeboys is a new comic drama about four friends from the South Bronx who spend one Friday night crashing parties, getting into fights, jumping subway turnstiles, and trying to pick up girls. Two of the friends are Latino, two are black. One of them, Willie, is unemployed and always sponging off his friends. Here he is with his social worker.
Look, Mr. Stevens, we're quite fed up with your behavior. We've sent you out to several work programs and you never show up. If you don't want your welfare checks terminated, you'd better straighten up.
This is because I'm black, right?
What are you talking about?
Look, you can be honest with me. You're doing this to me because I'm black, right?
Fine. I'll be honest. I'm doing this because I think you're a bum.
Oh, I'm a bum. You call me a bum because I'm black, right? See, if I was a white guy, I'd be eccentric. But now I gotta be a bum, right?
No, if you were a white guy, you'd be a white bum.
That was Dougie Doug as Willie. Hangin' with the Homeboys was written and directed by my guest, Joseph Vasquez. The 28-year-old filmmaker shared the Best Screenwriter Award this year at the Sundance Film Festival. Homeboys is his third film, but it's the first that has gone beyond the festival circuit into theatrical distribution. Hangin' with the Homeboys begins on a New York City train. Three toughs walk onto the train and start to threaten a young black man sitting alone. He talks back to them. The passengers are terrified, but take no action. The toughs grab the young man, throw him to the floor, and start beating him. The shouts and groans of fighting soon turn into hysterical laughter. As the four get up and dust themselves off, one addresses the shocked passengers as if they are his audience, and in fact, they are. "Ladies and gentlemen," he says, "thank you for attending another performance of Ghetto Theater." I asked Vasquez if he and his friends used to fake fights for theatrical effect when he was younger.
Yeah, we did all the time, in the subways and on the streets, yeah.
Give me an example of it, a real-life example.
Okay, the best one that we did was on the streets of the South Bronx. I was a student at City College at the time, and I was shooting a student film, and I had to buy three breakaway bottles for the student film that I was making. And then later, I changed the scene completely, so I wrote out the breakaway bottle scene. And I had these three breakaway bottles I had nothing to do with. So it was like jammy time on the streets of the South Bronx, you know, and it was like, you know, we're breaking the bottles over each other's heads in the South Bronx. It's pretty weird.
What kind of reaction did you get?
Oh, people were shocked and scared as hell. And then after someone would lay out on the floor and pretend they were knocked out, they'd get up 1 minute later and say, thank you for welcome, you know, for coming to Ghetto Theater. And just like exactly the way it is in the film.
What kind of reaction did you want to get?
That's the exact reaction we wanted to get. We wanted to shock people. I guess we wanted attention. And when we did it in white neighborhoods, it was kind of like, you know, hey, this is what you think we are, so this is what we're going to show you.
Right.
You know, and then we get up, and it's like, no, this is something totally different.
You know, I'm thinking in the South Bronx and, you know, in, like, hip-hop culture, that there was a place for painting, graffiti art. There's a place for dance. But what about, like, filmmaking and theater and writing? Were there street versions of it that people could do?
There were none. I mean, some people in my family said to me, you're crazy because you're in a rich man's profession and you're broke.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, there really was none. I just had to save up my pennies and, you know, shoot a lot of Super 8 when I was a kid. And, you know, until this day, I walk in the neighborhood and people don't know, you know, who I am or what I'm doing. They say, hey, man, you're still into that film crap? You know? And, they have no idea what's going on, you know?
was that just their view of film, or did they just think that there was no way you were going to make it because it's too hard?
Exactly. That's the view. Like, you know, what are you, kidding yourself? That kind of view, you know. And it's the same thing with people who are actors from that neighborhood. They're like, you're still into that acting jive, you know. And then all of a sudden when you see someone on screen, you go, ah, you know.
Now, do you think that old friends of yours would come to see the movie even if they didn't know it was yours? In other words, I'm wondering if you think that this is the kind of movie that's going to end up in art houses, or if it's going to have a more, you know, mass market kind of release and end up in urban theaters.
It belongs somewhere in between. Right now in New York, it's playing in an urban theater, and it's also playing in a more artsy theater in the Village. So it's a kind of film that's right in between. It's entertaining enough to be commercial, yet, you know, at the same time, it has a lot of strong points about, you know, urban life.
Do you think of Hanging with the Homeboys as an autobiographical film?
Yeah, it's a very personal film, definitely. Very personal film, 100% so.
The movie's about four friends. Two of the characters are black, two of them are Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if blacks and Latinos hung together in your neighborhood.
Oh, sure, because I'm considered Latino because from the outside I look Latino, even though I'm half black and half Hispanic. But, you know, no one could tell that I'm half black by looking at me. So I was considered Latino and I hung out with black guys and, you know, and there was another Spanish guy in the bunch. And, you know, at the end of the film is dedicated to a group of the guys I hung out with. And there's a lot of Latino names down there. There's Ephraim Vega and then there was me. And, you know, there's a lot. Yeah, we hung out all together.
Was there a different language at all? And I don't mean Spanish versus English. I mean more in terms of, like, street language for black friends and Hispanic friends?
Not really, because we all were brought up in the same neighborhood. You know, the only difference, of course, is some of the Spanish guys spoke Spanish. And believe it or not, a couple of them didn't, you know? And I was one of the ones that didn't because I'm half black and half Spanish. And there wasn't really any difference in the slangs or anything that we used because we all grew up together. You know, I knew a lot of those guys since I was like 12 or 13.
Were there cultural conflicts within your family between, you know, African-American tradition and Hispanic tradition?
Sure, definitely. I mean, my grandmother tries to convince me every day that I'm not black. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, your skin is not black. What are you talking about? You're black. It's based on ignorance and being naive and, you know, a lot of silly things. But the best part of it is, in actuality, you know, I took advantage of it and got the best part of both worlds. And at the same time, noticed that there are less differences than there are similarities in any culture, really. You know, we all want success. We all want to be happy. We all want money. We all want to be married and have a good relationship. And, you know, we all want the same things, basically. So what we're letting tear us apart are these stupid little trivial things.
Trivial things like what?
Like what you eat and what you look like and very superficial things, you know. You know, the color of your skin or you know, you, when you talk, you use more slang words than the next guy. You know, when I was working, I worked at a editing house, and basically everyone there was white, and they had no idea that I was half black. And, you know, I used to hear the comments of black people and this and that. And it's all based on ignorance, and usually the person's mouth that it comes out of, you know, when you hear them talk about other subject matters, too, they're just as stupid, so it doesn't matter, really.
Now, there's a character in the movie who he's African-American, and he keeps saying to people whenever he doesn't get what he wants, you're doing this to me because I'm black.
Right.
Where does that come from?
Lately, it sounds like Spike Lee at the Cannes Film Festival. Where does that come from? It comes from a lot of people that I've met in my neighborhood. And also, you know, I can also credit my uncle to part of that, who's now dead. Because, you know, there was a thing, like, when I was working in editing houses, he was like, oh, you're going over there to work for the white man, huh, and this and that, and, you know, and don't never trust the white man, and this, and all this philosophy, and, you know, and on the other hand, you know, you're saying about how they hold you down and this and that, but it's like, I look at my uncle, and it's like, what have you done for yourself, you know? The guy really didn't do much to get his life together on his own. So, I mean, how can you blame anybody? I mean, the funny thing is half the time that the white man isn't even thinking about you. They don't give a damn. You know, they're like, hey, you go about your business. I couldn't care less. So,
if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Joseph Vasquez, and he wrote and directed the new film Hanging with the Homeboys. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Joseph Vasquez is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film Hanging with the Homeboys. Now, you grew up in the South Bronx, which is where your movie is set. Did you shoot the film in the neighborhood that you grew up?
Part of the film takes place in the South Bronx, and then the other part, they travel into Manhattan for a good time. And, shot most of it in that same neighborhood.
Do you still have family living in the neighborhood?
No, not anymore, and that makes me very happy because, people probably at the South Bronx will say, what are you talking about? But, you know, with the event of crack, I mean, the South Bronx has really taken a dive. And before crack, it was a great neighborhood. I loved being there. And it's funny, I look at, like, my earlier films. I have two features before this, and especially the first feature is very optimistic about life in the South Bronx, you know, that it's just, you know, it's a different way of living, but it's still a lifestyle where you can grow and prosper. And, you know, my later films became more pessimistic about it, and I think that was a result of seeing crack taking over the neighborhood.
Were you out of the neighborhood before that happened?
Oh, no, I was still there, definitely.
So what were the differences you'd see in day-to-day life?
Oh, God, you see, there were complete people that, you know, who got addicted to crack. I think the problem was it's a drug that you can smoke. So a lot of people who did marijuana and light things like that said, hey, another drug you can smoke, it's a casual drug, you know? And they started taking it, and before you know it, their souls were lost, you know? And people that you saw and who were respected in the neighborhood suddenly turned into criminals. They had to rob and steal to make their living. Girls who were in the neighborhood, people were saying, oh, that girl is so gorgeous, she's so beautiful, oh, God, I'd love to meet her. Suddenly, you could buy that same girl on the street corner for like $4, you know, like 2 years later. So it was, it's very scary. It really turned the neighborhood upside down.
Were you ever worried about yourself trying that?
No, because I never got into drugs at all. Drugs really devastated my family. And, you know, I've seen so much. I mean, I've seen an uncle have a drug overdose, like, at the age of 10, and he was laying on the floor of the bathroom, and I had to help carry him up and, you know, and lift him up and bring him on the couch. And I'm, like, 10 years old, you know, seeing stuff like this. So, and my father, you know, had a lot of problems with drugs and brothers and cousins and everything. So seeing all of this has kind of, you know, scared straight, I guess you could call the term for it, just scared me straight.
One of the characters in Hanging with the Homeboys looks like maybe he'll get out of the neighborhood on
right.
a minority scholarship.
Right.
Was that a big issue with you, like whether you'd make it to college or not, and whether college would help you get out of the neighborhood?
Well, not whether I would make it to college, because I went to a college that was in Harlem, so I didn't think I would have a problem with that one. But as to getting out of the neighborhood, yeah, definitely, that was always a question. You know, it was a dream of mine of just, you know, not so much getting out of the neighborhood, but just moving up and doing something for real with my life. Because at that point, even the South Bronx wasn't a bad neighborhood to me. It had a reputation that was worse than what it was. But now it's turning into that reputation with crack. But, you know, my dream was just being able to do what I wanted to do, which was make movies, which, you know, I've been doing it since I was 12 years old with Super 8. And I was in love with it. And I'm glad that I got a chance to do it.
So what did you do as a kid with your Super 8?
Oh, I shot everything. You know, I shot all around the South Bronx, and I shot everything I could think of. And it was really funny. One time my uncle got upset because he saw me shooting this thing where, you know, all my friends when I was 12 were 12 also, you know. And he saw me shooting this thing where I had this 12-year-old kid shooting up, you know, dope. And, you know, when you're 12, you would pretend, oh, we're grown-ups doing it, you know. And my uncle saw it and just freaked out and took the camera from us. And he went out and shot some home movies. And, you know, we stood there holding the dog and stuff like that.
So you were making, like, a fiction film when you were 12?
Oh, yeah, constantly, yeah. I must have shot about 30 or 40 of them. And the funny thing about it is, like, you know, back then we were pretending we were grown-ups doing a scene where we would shoot somebody with a gun or shooting up dope or whatever. And then, you know, later in life when I looked at them as an adult, I said, you know, it's more frightening looking at this as kids shooting up dope. I mean, this goes to show you the kind of environment that I was around and you know, and just I knew things that, you know, 30-year-olds don't know, you know, at the age of 10.
Yeah, yeah. Can you put your finger on which movies you saw that made you really want to make movies yourself?
Everybody asks me that question, and there's tons of movies that I love, but a movie didn't really make me want to make movies. What made me want to make movies was a cousin of mine when I was about 10, 11, gave a home movie camera to my brothers as a present, like a Christmas present. And, you know, they shot, like, one film with it and put it down and were bored. And I was just fascinated by the thing with the lenses on it. And, you know, you could change lenses and you can open it up and load film and, you know, and you can shoot something and have it forever. And you know, and your vision, you can cut off people's vision. You know, you can show them only what you want them to see. And then all of a sudden you pan over and then they'll see something totally different that, you know, they didn't even know was in the frame, you know. So that's what fascinated me, was the camera rather than, you know, films that were being made.
Yeah. Did you go to the movies a lot when you were growing up?
Yeah, I went to the movies a whole lot, and I was the kind of kid who stayed up at, you know, 12 o'clock looking at the Late Late Show, and I'd go in school and be sleeping through the whole class, and the teacher would go, you gotta go to bed earlier, and I was like, yeah, but Betty Grable was on last night, and you know.
So. What were the theaters like in your neighborhood? Because I know that, where I live, for instance, in Center City, there's a lot of theaters that are really mostly like for teenagers.
Right.
And
it's the same. That was the kind of theater. Matter of fact, that theater that you're talking about with teenagers and that is the same theater that right now is showing Homeboys.
Well, those theaters are usually like a disaster. They're not clean.
Oh, they're not clean. And the sound is terrible.
The sound is terrible. The projection's terrible. And no one's going to fix it.
That's the theater.
Right. And then the bathrooms are really dangerous, right?
Yeah, that's the theater. You got it. And I worked in that theater for a short while, too, when I was in college. Like, when I was a kid, I went there and saw the karate movies and mm-hmm. saw all the black movies, Shaft and Superfly meets, you know, meets the Wolfman, whatever. You know, I saw all those movies there.
Well, you know, another thing is during the movies, people are always, like, talking.
Oh, yeah, they're yelling at the screen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
What do you mean, man? You know, the character on screen says, you know, I love you. And it's like, oh, man, forget her. You know, yelling at the screen. Yeah, that's the theater.
So would that bother you when you were really getting caught up in a movie and everybody's yelling at the screen and breaking the spell?
No, because I was usually the one that started it.
Really?
Yeah, I was the guy sitting in the front row. What do you mean you love her? You know? Forget her! You know? Yeah, I was part of it. That was going to a movie in the Bronx. I mean, as a matter of fact, the first time I went to a movie at a really classy theater in Manhattan, it was really funny. I was like, everybody's quiet. What's going on? Nobody's talking. What is this? You know? And then, you know, and then I remember going to, like, a year later after that experience, going to a theater, and the projector, like, you know, stopped or something, a frame burned or whatever, you know, when it was technical difficulty.
Uh-huh.
And everybody was pretty quiet and pretty patient. But, you know, I was such in a habit of being in my neighborhood theater when that happened. You go, yo! Yo, what's up? Hey! So, you know, I would do that, and people just turned around and looked at me like, what is this guy's problem? You know, and I was like 15 or something. You know?
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So I guess it doesn't bother you now if one of your movies is on screen and people are yelling up things at the screen.
No, because that's the way they enjoy it in their particular environment, you know? So, hey, if they're yelling, it's because they're enjoying it. When they're quiet, it's because they hate it over there. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Vasquez, and he wrote and directed the new film Hanging with the Homeboys. Now, I read it in an article about you that on your way to a New York Film Critics screening of Hanging with the Homeboys, you were busted.
Yeah.
And it was, mistaken identity or something?
Yeah.
What happened?
The cops were really stupid. They're, you know, they walked up to me and they said, where are you coming from? And I'm standing there with this little old lady, my grandmother, you know, to go down to a screening of the film. And they said, where'd you just come from? And I said, my grandmother's house. And then God, I don't even remember. It's like I tried to block most of it out. But they then grabbed me and threw me up against the wall and threw handcuffs on me because I said something like, what? Get away from me, man. You got no reason to be coming up to me. So at that point, they got very hostile. And that was it. Then they threw me in a police car. My grandmother's like, can I get him in the police car with him? She was going hysterical, having a heart attack. And they were like, no, you can't. And they just threw me in the police car and closed the doors and took me downtown. And then the funny part of it is when I'm in the jail cell and a cop comes up to me, you know, because I'm complaining, I'm saying, you're a real idiot, you know that? I mean, you know I did nothing wrong and this and that. And he comes up to me, he goes, look, man, you got to understand, we were looking for a guy with blue pants. I said, listen. He says, we were looking for a guy with blue pants. And I said, I got on black pants. Then he goes, look, he was a dark-skinned Hispanic. I said, I'm a light-skinned Hispanic. He goes, look, he had these white sneakers on. I said, I got black sneakers on. He goes, there's no talking to you. There's no talking to you. You know, so that was the funniest part of it all. And then another funny thing is he wrote me two summonses.
Oh.
One for disorderly conduct or something, and another one for resisting arrest.
Did you tell him that you had a screening of your movie you were on the way to?
Yeah, and he made fun of me. He said, yeah, come on, Spike. Like that, you know.
Oh, gee.
And I was like, you idiot, you know. So at the screening, I just ripped up the summonses, and my producer freaked out and picked up all the pieces later because he was panicking. But I just ripped them up. I was so angry. I would, in a case like that, I would rather do the time than pay the summonses, just on the principle of the matter, you know?
So what does that incident say to you? I mean, does it have like a larger meaning to you, or do you think of it as just one of those things?
Well, it's part based on racism because, I mean, you know, a Hispanic guy coming out of the building, and, you know, I wear a bandana and have a beard. I don't look too clean cut right now in the stage of my life that I'm in. And, you know, it's a lot of it has to do with racism. You know, I mean, come on, I walked out of the building with a little old woman, you know? It's like, yeah, I'm going to be the guy carrying the gun, you know? It's like, I mean, it's just stupidity. And then when they saw, obviously, they searched me and saw I didn't have a gun because they threw me up against the wall right away and saw I didn't have a gun. At that point, they still arrested me just because I was saying, you know, what the hell are you guys doing? You know, you have no right to do this to me, blah, blah. Then they just wanted to arrest me to prove a point, you know? And the point is that they're a bunch of idiots. And, you know, that's the point that they made to me. You know, there's a scene in the movie in Homeboys that deals with policemen and shows them pretty much the way I see them, you know? I mean, every experience I've had with a cop, I can honestly say this. Every experience I've had with policemen have been a bad one. And most people I know say this. I remember my first experience with a cop was when I was like 14 years old. I was at a friend's house, and his mother just recently got divorced from like this crazy man. And he came and kicked down the door of the apartment and started beating the hell out of her. And my friend was trying to break up the fight. He was like 14, too. And he told me to go get a cop because the precinct was like one block up the street. And I went up the street, saw a cop, and I said, hey, officer, there's this guy beating up this woman right up the street. And the cop looks at me and goes, ah, she probably deserves it. You know? I mean, this is the kind of experiences that I've always had with cops. So, you know, it's nothing new. I expect it from them.
So you said at this point in your life, you're not very clean cut. How come here you are, you know, up and coming screenwriter, director?
Well, clean cut in terms of the in terms of the look, you know, I just... You know, right now, I'm bumming around. I get tired of looking one way, so I change it. And then 2 years from now, I change it to something else. And, you know, just the same way someone cuts their hair because they're tired of having it long. That's all.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. It's been a pleasure.
Joseph Vasquez wrote and directed the new film Hangin' with the Homeboys. It's already opened in New York and will open in other cities later this summer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the Hollywood-Washington connection. Journalist Ronald Brownstein explains how Washington politicians use Hollywood celebrities, and vice versa. Remember the 1963 hit Sally Go Round the Roses? Rock historian Ed Ward tries to decipher why such an unlikely song made it into the top 10. And TV critic David Bianculli explains how public TV has changed his summers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN has now adopted a resolution that requires Iraq to pay for destroying its most dangerous weapons. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
By unanimous vote, the Security Council approved the Secretary General's plan for destroying Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, and it demanded that Baghdad pay the bill, estimated to run into hundreds of millions of dollars. But Iraq's envoy told the world body that his government rejects liability for the cost, but is willing to voluntarily destroy the weapons itself under UN supervision. The measure also extends the 45-day deadline for disposing of the weapons. Meanwhile, experts are conducting inspections of Iraq's chemical weapons, and the UN is expected to send another team this week to inspect the nuclear sites identified by an Iraqi defector. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
In London, officials say that Douglas Brand, who had been sentenced to life in prison in Iraq earlier this year, has now been released. Brand, who was sentenced on a spying charge, was set free after the intervention of former British Prime Minister Edward Heath. The Soviet Union has reportedly offered to sell Israel a missile defense system that up to now had been kept a secret. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
According to Israeli press reports, Soviet arms manufacturers approached representatives of Rafael, the Israeli Weapons Development Authority, at the Paris Air Show and Weaponry Exhibition. They offered to sell Israel the F-300, an anti-missile system that the manufacturers say is far more effective than the Patriot anti-missile system. Israeli representatives to the air show were completely surprised by the offer, and defense sources said it is being closely studied. Israel is currently developing its own anti-missile system, the Arrow, with American funding. Also at the air show, Soviet officials reportedly invited a senior Israeli Air Force official to inspect the MiG-31, the most advanced Soviet warplane. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Moscow would like to have direct foreign investment for its industry in place of loans. According to the Soviet prime minister, there are plans to have the West contribute to a fund to back the Soviet ruble. Prime Minister Pavlov is quoted as saying that there can be no joint program with the West on taking the Soviet economy out of crisis, as they, in his view, do not know the situation in his country. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 6 points to close at 2,993.96 on volume of some 133 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News. Planes and ships are taking U.S. military families from the Philippines after volcanic eruptions ravaged two military bases. All 20,000 dependents will be moved from the Philippines over the next few days. Tons of ash on Clark and Subic Bay bases have rendered their airfields impossible to use. Government officials say 180,000 people have sought shelter in refugee centers, with thousands more finding a safe haven with their families. Results in elections in India indicate that the Congress Party of slain leader Rajiv Gandhi has won the largest number of seats in the country's parliament. However, to rule the country and elect a new prime minister, the party will have to either form a minority government or join in a coalition with another political party. Mark Tully of the BBC has more.
India is now just waiting to see how far short of an absolute majority the Congress Party falls. Several leaders of the National Front have been publicly talking about the possibility of joining a Congress-led coalition. The Congress will not formally choose a Prime Minister until its MPs meet, probably in 2 days' time. But two candidates have emerged. One is Mr. Narasimha Rao, the veteran politician who took over as party president after Rajiv Gandhi's assassination. The other is Mr. Sharad Pawar, the Chief Minister of Maharashtra, where the party did outstandingly well in this election. Mr. Narasimha Rao is the candidate favored by most of the present leadership of the Congress, and especially by the politicians who were particularly close to Rajiv Gandhi.
Mark Tully of the BBC. Germany and Poland have signed a landmark friendship and non-aggression treaty. This agreement says that neither country will use force against the other, and both nations agree that their top officials will hold regular consultations. Germany also promises to help Poland finance its economic changes. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward is beginning a series of pieces on one-hit wonders, groups that hit the charts with a mighty blaze and then vanished. A lot of the time, the songs that brought the glory were novelties, but in the case of the J-Nets and Sally Go Round the Roses, Ed says the song was great.
Very few records as mysterious as this one. It's a chant repeating itself over and over for 3 minutes and 15 seconds. The words change very slightly, but the story remains veiled in mystery. Was cut in 1963 by the J-Nets, four Bronx girls who had been recording without success since 1956 for a variety of tiny record labels. Before this record, for instance, they'd cut something called We Belong to Each Other on the Goldie label. Somehow, Abner Spector, no relation to Phil Spector, decided to sign them to a new label he'd started called Tough. Its trademark was a boxing glove. The J-Nets' names were Mary Sue Wells, Ethel Davis, Ada Ray, and Yvonne Bushnell. Somewhere I seem to remember reading that Mary Sue Wells' mother was their manager, and that she let them practice at her place and kept after them to stay in school. Certainly the fact that they'd been professionals, even at a low level, for 7 years before they hooked up with Spector indicates a great deal of commitment, a great deal of faith. But where was Spector's faith in the J-Nets? When the record came out, the B-side was Sally Go Round the Roses Sing Along Without the J-Nets. The next two records he put out by them, Keep an Eye on Her and Snowman, Snowman, Sweet Potato Nose, had the same sort of B-sides. Maybe there was just so much tape. Maybe he was trying to make sure nobody played the wrong side. If you're interested, those two songs, along with No Love at All, their last for Tough, are on the J-Nets album, Sally Go Round the Roses, which ought to set you back about $50.
Sally Go Round the Roses.
They won't tell your secret.
No, the roses won't.
Sally-Go-Round the Roses is a jump rope game. I don't know how it's played, but the chorus of the song could be heard on playgrounds 30 years ago. The Jeanettes made up the rest. What was Sally's secret, the one the Roses wouldn't tell? Sally-Go-Round the Roses was one of the best-selling records of 1963, getting as high as number two. It was one of the very last vocal group records to be a smash hit before the Beatles came along and changed the rules of the game. It's an amazing performance. The Jeanettes sing louder and softer. The instrumental backing, that's allegedly Buddy Miles on drums, by the way, is subtle, with a reed organ playing a tiny cue to start each verse. What was Sally's secret? What's the mystery of this song? What was it that caught people's ears and made them buy it? A lesbian from Harlem I once met told me that it was the traditional last dance in the bars she frequented. Grace Slick later recorded it with her band, The Great Society. I don't need to tell you this. They didn't come close.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle, and he's the co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Let me share an ongoing dilemma we face in lining up guests for Fresh Air. We want a certain rock star to be on the show, and after months of getting turned down by this rock star's publicist, we're told he'll be happy to be on our show, but only to talk about his favorite cause, the rainforest. Or the same will happen with a celebrity actor. Yes, they'll be a guest, but what they really want to talk about is their recent fact-finding trip to Nicaragua. More celebrities than ever seem to have adopted causes, and more politicians than ever seem to have adopted celebrities. Warren Beatty was in Gary Hart's camp, Arnold Schwarzenegger and George Bush's. Ronald Brownstein is the author of a new book about the connection between Hollywood celebrities and Washington politics. It's called The Power and the Glitter. Brownstein is a political correspondent for the LA Times. Early in the 1988 presidential campaign, he started writing about how candidates build a financial base. His research led him to Hollywood, where he attended many fundraising parties.
One night in the course of doing this research, I went to a dinner at a home of one of the young political activists on the west side of Los Angeles, and there were all sorts of people there from Hollywood and the political community. And as we were sitting around this table talking about this whole phenomenon, I realized about halfway through that even though I lived in Washington, I was the only person in that room who had not been to Ted Kennedy's house. And I said, huh. Something is going on here. And as I began to research the book, what I realized was that, you know, we tend to write stories every 4 years about how Hollywood has discovered politics. But as I began to do the research on the book, I mean, I found that there was this incredibly rich history there going all the way back to the 1920s.
Do you think that stars are courted by politicians according to what the star symbolizes? For instance, when George Bush was running for president, one of the things he was supposed to be overcoming in his image was, you know, the wimp.
Mm-hmm.
So who does he get in his camp? Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, and Chuck Norris as well. They do something else that's very interesting. That you know, in talking to Lee Atwater, I talked to Atwater at length for writing the book, and you know, he talked, I think, quite explicitly about the fear of Bush being portrayed by the Democrats as this elitist preppy wimp, this blue blood from Connecticut, and they were very conscious of the cultural box that the Democrats were trying to erect around them with the Ann Richards speech at the convention. You may remember, you know, poor George. Born with a silver foot in his mouth and all of this. And one of the ways they wanted to get out of that was by stressing the West Texan Main Street beef jerky side of George Bush. They did that in part by surrounding him with country and Western stars. I mean, just about every other day on the campaign trail, George Bush had some country and Western group, you know, some pedal steel guitarist around him. And it reached its apogee, I think, when they sent him campaigning through Illinois on a bus with Loretta Lynn and Crystal Gayle. And there's this image of this son of a senator from Connecticut sitting in the back of a bus with Loretta Lynn and Crystal Gayle strumming a guitar.
Here's what I've never been able to figure out. How did George Bush
get Arnold Schwarzenegger in his camp. And I ask that knowing that Schwarzenegger's married to Maria Shriver. And isn't Shriver the daughter of Sergeant Shriver, who was in the Kennedy administration, Democratic lineage?
We have the Austrian black sheep of the Kennedy clan here, Schwarzenegger. Well, Schwarzenegger is emerging as the preeminent conservative spokesman in Hollywood. But in the 80s, as I talk about in the book, Charlton Heston was forced to be the spokesman on virtually everything. I mean, he was the one defending Reagan. He was the one fighting gun control. He was the one debating Paul Newman on Nightline about the nuclear freeze. I mean, that one of the low moments, by the way, in the history of the relationship between Hollywood and politics is having the nuclear freeze debated by Charlton Heston and Paul Newman. But nonetheless, Heston had to be everywhere, largely because there were virtually no other leading conservatives willing to get out there and take a stand on issues for Republicans. What's happening now is that Schwarzenegger, as in some ways the biggest box office draw in the world, at least Time Magazine has told us that, is increasingly willing to get out there himself. I mean, he's spending a lot of time at the White House with Bush. He's going out there and speaking for a variety of conservative causes. And I think that in the next few years, Schwarzenegger will emerge, unlikely as it seems, as a visible figure in Republican circles. He will supplant Heston as the right's principal spokesman in Hollywood.
Can you give us a sense of how politicians court the star that they want to use for their campaign?
Yeah, I think politicians really spend more time courting the Hollywood fundraisers than they do the Hollywood stars themselves. The politicians mostly depend on intermediaries to actually deliver the stars. The most dramatic trend that I think you see in the 70 years of this relationship is the growing sense of importance in Hollywood. I mean, these people increasingly believe that it is entirely appropriate that the people who want to be president should pass through their living rooms first. In the 1988 presidential campaign, Norman Lear and a group of very wealthy liberal Democrats sort of established themselves as a rump group and announced that they expected all of the Democrats to come by for their approval before they would help them. And in fact, dutifully, one by one, each of the Democrats who wanted to be president presented themselves for inspection to this group of wealthy Hollywood liberals. I mean, that suggests that something is a little bit out of whack here in where the relationship has gone, that, Louis Mayer in the 1920s besieged Herbert Hoover. Jack Warner and Daryl Zanuck, I mean, they wanted to be invited to the White House. They wanted to be accepted by FDR. They wanted the social validation that politicians could bestow. Now it's really become the opposite. I mean, the people in Hollywood sort of view themselves as more serious and more worthy than these flighty, money-obsessed politicians and really give them a pretty bad time.
What's in it for politicians to have Hollywood stars behind them?
Well, there are really two things, money and attention. Money is the most tangible and the most dramatic and the most compelling reason why politicians go to Hollywood. It is clearly an important stop on the national money hunt. The second thing is that stars draw the media, and politicians can use them to attract attention to their own campaigns and their own causes.
What's in it for the stars who affiliate with political causes or with politicians?
I think stars are attracted to it on two levels. On the one hand, politics offers them an opportunity to present themselves as serious people. You know, when I was talking to Robert Redford in the course of writing the book, and he said, you know, Hollywood figures, people in Hollywood often feel like what they do is shallow and insubstantial, and politics offers them a way to say, look, I'm not really this piece of fluff that you see five nights a week on reruns. I'm really a serious person. I care deeply about the world, and I have all of these thoughts. The second thing that politics does for stars is it allows them to focus their celebrity on their own aims. I think that's really important. Stars like being famous because it makes them rich, but they don't like being famous because of the 200 paparazzi taking pictures of them every time they get out of their house. The prosaic demands of fame can be very demanding and oppressive at times. Politics allows them to take that glare of celebrity, that fame, and to sort of turn it on its head, use it for their own aims. I think they find that very attractive.
Sometimes really confusing things happen, like when Jessica Lange made the movie about the plight of small farmers. Mm-hmm. She ended up testifying to Congress about small farmers. Right. And you figure, okay, no matter how much she really believes in this cause, I mean, is she the most credible spokesperson because of the 3 months of research she perhaps did for the movie?
Yeah, the image of Jessica Lange and Sissy Spacek and Jane Fonda testifying on farm problems really exemplifies the problem. I mean, the problem is not so much that Hollywood figures get out there and talk about what they don't know about. I mean, that's lamentable, but a lot of people do that in our society. The real problem is that the way our debate has been trivialized, the way that the competition for those 15 seconds on the evening news, the soundbite, has come to define our politics, it's entirely logical for causes and candidates candidates to try to attract the camera worthy stars. And that leads you into these kind of absurd situations, like a House committee inviting Jessica Lange to talk about life on the farm.
Are you very cynical about the relationship between celebrities and politicians?
No, I'm not entirely cynical about it. I mean, I think there are many people, many celebrities who get out there and just want to see their name in the paper or are just so intoxicated with their own celebrity, really, just so happy to hear their own voice that they'll talk about anything. I think there are a number of others, though, who are simply in politics, get involved in politics because they're trying to figure out something rational to do with this enormous spotlight that follows them around, this enormous platform with which they've been handed. And strangely enough, I found this to be most poignant in some of the younger celebrities who can say and do some of the dumbest things, but also, I think, in many cases, get into politics because they're trying to send out a message to their very young fans that it is important to be engaged in the society, that it's that, you know, that the that just being cool and having an attitude and sort of turning everything out, tuning everything out, isn't really the way to go. So, no, I'm not entirely cynical about it. I think there are a lot of people who are involved out of the best of motives, even if it doesn't always turn out in practice to be the best of decisions for them to be involved.
Well, Ronald Brownstein, thanks very much for talking with us.
All right, thanks for having me.
Ronald Brownstein is the author of The Power and the Glitter. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. South Africa's parliament has abolished the last major apartheid law in that country. The African National Congress, however, says it's a symbolic move and it will do nothing to improve the situation for most blacks in South Africa. Katie Davis reports on Cambodian versus Latino gang warfare in Long Beach, California. The Virginia Military Institute can remain all male, that's according to a federal judge who made a ruling, and we'll talk with a record producer for the Disney Company about a new album they put out entitled For the Children. It's to benefit pediatric AIDS, and we'll hear music from Little Richard, Stephen Bishop, and Brian Wilson.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. TV critic David Bianculli says summer television isn't what it used to be, and he's happy about that.
Until the end of the 60s, TV was pretty simple. New series would show up each fall, along with commercials for the new models of American cars, and keep running almost as long as those cars did. The shows would premiere in September and go all the way until June, even the really bad ones like My Mother the Car. Then came the summer reruns, which continued until September, when the cycle started all over again. There were a few attempts back then to break out of that rut, the most famous being Patrick McGoohan's The Prisoner, which showed up, believe it or not, as a 1968 summer replacement for the Jackie Gleason show. But for the most part, the TV networks would take a summer vacation along with everyone else, and that's the way it was. At least until the mid-80s, when PBS began putting new series on during the summer and found out that people would actually watch them. Alive from Off-Center, American Masters, and POV were some of the early pioneers, and their success has led to such welcome summer experiments as Northern Exposure on CBS. So, on this week when summer officially begins, it's time to welcome back POV and say thanks. POV, which stands for Point of View, is a series of independent documentaries with proudly subjective viewpoints. This year's subjects range from a mostly comic visit to the annual Twins convention in Twinsburg, Ohio, to this week's season opener, a very intimate film by Peter Adair. It's called Absolutely Positive, and it's absolutely quietly spellbinding.
I've been making films for 30 years. My movies have always been a way of exploring subjects of personal interest. When I wondered about religion, I made a film about it. When I realized I was gay, I made a film about it. When I worried about the bomb, I made a film about it. This has become a very expensive form of therapy. A while ago, I tested positive for the HIV virus, and my doctor told me this means the chances are very strong I'll get AIDS sometime in the years ahead. I was confused because nothing had changed, yet everything had changed. I decided to make a film about it.
Adair went out and found 11 people who had contracted the virus from drug abuse, lovers, or spouses. Absolutely Positive is just them talking individually and honestly about their thoughts, lives, hopes, and fears. One man, recalling the first time he met anyone with AIDS, fights back tears at the memory.
I remember this. This total fear coming over me. And just a lot of fear. And they introduced us, a group of people, to one another. And the guy with AIDS made his point to shake hands with everybody there. And I remember it was my first time meeting somebody with AIDS and the fear. And I didn't want to touch him. I didn't want him to shake my hand. And so I put my hand in my pocket. And I waited till we got to a restaurant so that I could go into the washroom. I felt so sad and so guilty. That someone who was in a place of needing so much compassion and so much understanding, that I wanted to run away and I didn't even want to touch him.
Absolutely Positive is touching every step of the way, up to and including Adair's personal postscript. Sitting down and talking with people is a cheap way to tell a story and make a documentary, but when it works, there's almost nothing better.
Sometimes I wonder how I'd feel if they found a cure tomorrow. The irony is that I think I'd be depressed. I've tried so hard to be realistic about things, to accept this change of fortune, that it's become a part of who I am. And if that part were taken away, I know there'd be something missing. I'd get over it, though.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, endangered species, poachers, and undercover agents. We talk with environmental journalist Mark Reisner. Also, we meet the authors of Are You Two Together? A Gay and Lesbian Travel Guide to Europe. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.